Okay, tonight we're going to have a fun night looking at Revelation chapter 6 because we're going to talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So, let's kind of get the setting in mind before we actually get into the text itself. Remember, John is on the island of Patmos. He sees the door of heaven open. He hears a voice from heaven saying, "Come up here, and you're going to see the things that are going to take place after this." And so John then is transported in spirit into heaven. John sees God sitting on his throne. He has a seven-sealed scroll in his right hand. He also sees four living creatures before the throne. They are angels that are protecting the holiness of God. He sees 24 elders sitting on 24 thrones around the throne of God. He sees that they're dressed in white. They have crowns on their heads. And then we see where the four living creatures burst forth into song. They're singing to him who sits on the throne, "Holy, holy, holy." And soon we see where the 24 elders join in praise as well. And as they do so, they take off their crowns and they lay it before him who sits on the throne. Then we read about a great angel that is flying through the heavens. And he's saying, "Who is worthy to take the scroll and to open the seals?" And there's silence in heaven. No one seems to be worthy. The four living creatures don't say anything. The 24 elders don't say anything. The myriads and myriads and myriads of angels there in heaven say nothing at all. And this bothers John. And he's troubled deeply to the point of shedding tears. And one of the 24 elders gets up and walks over to John and comforts him and says, "There is one here who's worthy. And he is the lion from the tribe of Judah." And so here's John looking around for a lion. But the lion becomes a lamb. Of course, we're understanding the imagery of all of this. And it's the lamb who takes the scroll from the right hand of him who sits on the throne. And now all praise goes to Jesus the Lamb. So when we looked at chapter 4 a couple of weeks ago, we see where all praise went to him who sits on the throne. All praise was directed to God the Father. In chapter 5, we see where all praise is directed to Jesus the Lamb, because he alone is worthy to take the scroll and to open the seals. So tonight, we're going to break open four of those seals. And we're going to see the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so I'm going to name each of these horses because I think the name will help us understand what is going to happen. And so the first thing I want us to note in verses 1 and 2 is the white horse named Counterfeit. Revelation chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a loud voice like thunder, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat upon it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." Notice first of all the interpretation of the horse. "Behold, a white horse." I think the color white is very significant here because a white horse always symbolizes military conquest. For example, back in the days of the Roman Empire, when Rome was victorious over an enemy, they would always have a parade through the streets of Rome. The general who led that army to victory would lead the parade, and he was always astride a white horse. So the people of Rome knew they were victorious when they saw their general on a white horse. When you get over to Revelation chapter 19, we see when Jesus Christ comes back again, he comes back as a warrior. He comes back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He comes back to conquer his enemy. He comes back astride a white horse. So the white horse is always symbolic of military victory. Now notice now the identification of the rider on the white horse. It says there in verse 2, "He who sat upon it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. Now, in some of the commentaries I've read in preparing this lesson, there are those who say that the rider on the white horse is Jesus Christ. And they base that on the idea of Revelation chapter 19, that when Christ comes back again, he comes astride a white horse. So it would only seem natural, I suppose, for some to think that Jesus is the rider on this horse. But I do not believe that is the case. And there's two reasons why I do not believe that Jesus is the rider on this white horse. Number one, because Jesus has just broken the first seal, and that begins the great tribulation period. Jesus does not come back until the end of the great tribulation, not the beginning. And so there's a 7-year period before Jesus ever appears in our study of the book of Revelation. But here's even a better reason, I think. Notice this rider has a crown on his head. And the Greek word there that is translated crown is Stephanos, where we get the name Stephen. But it refers to a laurel wreath. And the laurel wreath was always handed out when a runner won a race, say at an Olympic Games. I mean, a laurel wreath was like receiving a gold medal. Well, you know, a laurel wreath would not last very long. It would soon perish. But that's what the victors would receive in some kind of athletic contest in biblical times. But when we talk about crowns on the head of Jesus as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he does not wear a Stephanos. He does not wear a laurel wreath. He wears a diadem. It's a royal crown. It's a kingly crown. And so there's the wrong kind of crown on the head of this one who rides on the white horse. Now notice also, he has a bow in his hand. And this is rather interesting because he doesn't have any arrows. So he has a bow, no arrows. What is the value of a bow if you don't have any arrows? There's no value to it at all. And so this suggests that he comes conquering, but he does so in a deceitful kind of manner. He does so through intrigue, through negotiation, not by military conquest. So, having understood that, let's kind of look at the situation, because I believe the rider on the white horse is the Antichrist. In fact, he's going to be the rider on all the horses that we talk about tonight. So let's kind of think things through here for a moment. As you know, I believe that in being a pre-trib, pre-millennial. So I'll just get that out there in case you had forgotten. That is, I do not believe the church is going to go through the tribulation. So, sometime, hopefully in the near future, Jesus Christ is going to come for his church. And let's just assume that 2 billion people are suddenly caught up in the air to meet the Lord. What do you think that's going to do to this earth when 2 billion people suddenly disappear? First of all, I didn't put this in the notes, but it was pointed out in my class on Sunday, and I think it's very significant to note. If 2 billion people were suddenly removed from this earth, can you imagine what would happen to the stock market? Can you imagine what would happen to people's businesses? Can you imagine what would happen to the value of your money? I mean, a dollar would be worth nothing. And it doesn't make any difference whose currency you're talking about. Money has no value. Period. You can think of it in other ways. Like here's a couple of pilots that are born again Christians flying a 747. And they're suddenly lifted out of that plane. Or you can talk about people driving their automobiles and they're born again Christians and they're suddenly lifted out of their automobiles. I mean, can you imagine all the chaos, confusion, the economic problems that are going to take place once the rapture of the church occurs? Every nation on the face of the earth is going to be affected. Then another thought. Look at the Middle East. Here's this tiny nation of Israel. And the Arab nations for some time have tried to conquer this nation, but have not been able to do so. And they will not be able to do so. And when we studied the book of Revelation, we talked about Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. And that's when Russia, along with some Muslim Arab nations, are going to ally together and invade this tiny nation of Israel. And the book of Ezekiel tells us God is going to be on the side of Israel, and God is going to see that this tiny nation of Israel succeeds and Israel conquers Russia and her Muslim Arab allies. Can you imagine the Arab world being stunned by that? Can you imagine the whole world being surprised at that? This tiny nation of Israel defeating nations that are far, far more populous than the tiny nation of Israel. I don't know when the Ezekiel 38-39 war is going to happen. There's all kinds of different ideas in that respect. Some believe it has to happen before the rapture. Some believe it could occur between the rapture of the church and the beginning of the tribulation, because there could be a gap between those two events, which I do believe. Doc Bishore believed that the rapture of the church and the great tribulation was on the very same day. In other words, the same day in which the church is raptured, that's when the Antichrist comes to power. That was his position. That's not my position. I'm not saying that he is wrong, but I'm saying that he will not allow for the idea that there could be some years of time between the two, or even months of time. So there can be such a thing as a gap between those events. Some actually believe that the Gog-Magog war doesn't take place until the end of the millennium. But I'm going to assume, just for the fun of assuming here, that this battle takes place before the Great Tribulation takes place. Maybe after the rapture, right before the rapture, doesn't make much difference. It's going to affect everybody on the face of the earth, especially those Muslim Arab nations. They cannot defeat the nation of Israel. I mean, that ought to reveal who the real God is. Is it Jehovah or is it Allah? See? So we look at the instability of the times now. That's what we're talking about here, the instability of the times. So 2 billion people have been raptured. Israel has conquered Russia and these Muslim allies. Now there comes along a strong leader, a very charismatic, handsome figure. He's not handsome very long because he gets one of his eyes knocked out, according to the book of Zechariah, but I don't imagine he comes on the scene that way. He comes on as a very appealing individual. And now the Arab people for the first time are willing to be serious about negotiating with Israel, because the Orthodox Jews want a temple on Temple Mount. And so he establishes a covenant between the Arab nations and the nation of Israel, allowing the Jews to build that temple. Now understand something. The Antichrist also wants that temple built. I mean, he has a selfish motive behind this. And the reason why he wants that temple built is because when that temple is built, the Apostle Paul tells us he's going to seize control of that temple and proclaim himself to be God. It's going to be his temple. Even though the book of Revelation says it's the temple of God, and we call it the tribulation temple, and I'm going to talk about that temple. In fact, I'll spend a whole hour on that temple when we get to Revelation chapter 11. But we're moving along rather slowly, so it'll be a few weeks before we get there. Here's what I'm saying. This charismatic leader comes along and brings about peace in the Middle East. He's able to do something that no other world leader has been able to accomplish. So I guess you could say this. If there is some world leader who's able to bring about a peace in the Middle East, that individual is, could be labeled anyway, the Antichrist. But we're going to see he brings about a worldwide peace, because the whole world now is looking for somebody. I mean, the rulers of all the nations of the world are looking for somebody to bring about a sense of stability in an otherwise extremely chaotic world. Now, there's something interesting about this Antichrist riding on the white horse. Notice he has a bow in his hand. We said he has a bow, but he does not have any arrows to shoot. Now, in the Greek, the word that is translated bow could likewise be translated rainbow. Maybe that's why he doesn't have any arrows, because maybe what he has in his hand is a rainbow. I don't know. Probably not. But the word is the same word. That's the point I'm making. So, think about this. What is the symbol of a rainbow but a covenant promise, right? I mean, when God gave the rainbow to Noah, it was a covenant that he was making with Noah that never again would he destroy the world with a flood. So the rainbow has a symbol in the scripture of a covenant promise. Remember what the Antichrist does. He forms a covenant between Jews and Muslim Arabs for the purpose of building that temple on Temple Mount. Now, I want us to see something about the insecurity of the times in which we live today. I want to bring this lesson right up to snuff, so to speak. I believe today that our world is closer to a war than it's been in decades, perhaps since 1962 in the Bay of Pigs. You see where North Korea is playing around with nuclear missiles? Oh, yes, I'm very much aware of these negotiating talks that are supposed to take place between the president of North Korea and President Trump. But you need to remember that these rumors came out of South Korea. We've never actually heard the president of North Korea make this offer. And now President Trump has said, yes, I'm willing to meet with the president of North Korea. But you haven't heard a peep out of him since Trump has agreed to bring about the negotiations. And there's all this controversy about these negotiations. It would seem to me, anyway, that that would be a good thing. But there are liberals who don't trust either of these men and their ability to negotiate. And so that becomes a problem. And so the news, to some degree, is not too hot on these negotiations. So I'm aware they're out there. But I'm also aware that the president of North Korea is very, very fond of his missiles and his nuclear abilities and wants to refine them and has a dislike not only for President Trump, but has a much dislike for America. In fact, it was Lindsey Graham who said this. That's been a couple of weeks back now. If North Korea shoots off another missile, there's a 30% chance President Trump will go to war. And if they send up another nuclear missile, there's 70% chance we'll go to war. Then you have Nikki Haley, our UN ambassador, has offered conclusive evidence that Iran has violated the nuclear agreement set up under President Obama. And certainly we don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. What is going to happen then? And then we have the recent decision by President Trump to make Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And I applaud him for that. I think that's one of the best things that he has done. Because the Bible says that God is going to bless those who bless Israel and God is going to curse those who curse Israel. I believe that's a promise that's very, very true today. And so when we have a president that stands behind the nation of Israel, that is a very good thing. And I know that they've already got a building there in Jerusalem. They're already fixing this building up, which will become the future embassy. They have to make this building extremely secure, and that's the big expense in this whole thing. Just getting a building is one thing. Making it secure becomes another issue. And so the promise is right now, by May, perhaps, of next year, sometime next year, the embassy will be moved from Tel Aviv to the city of Jerusalem. Well, you already know how the world thinks of that. You already know that the United Nations is totally opposed to it. You already know that the Pope of the Catholic Church is opposed to it. And so you can say, of course, Abbas of the Palestinians, why, he's snorting mad over it. So you can see this is going to cause some problems. And of course, Trump had been warned, you know, if you do this, there's likely to be some kind of war. Certainly there are going to be a lot of protests. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I plan sometime to do a whole lecture just on this very issue. I like to do things that are current, and I don't know whether I'll do it this year or wait till the embassy moves, but I think there's some biblical implications here, and I want to bring them out. So we know that the Antichrist comes on the scene when the world is threatened with or engaged in a major war. Remember what Jesus said, you will hear of wars and rumors of war, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Now we as Christians have always believed that as we near the end time, things are going to get worse and worse. That's exactly what Paul said, times are going to get worse and worse. That was his letter to Timothy. And everybody has heard of Armageddon. I mean, a person may never have opened their Bible, but the word Armageddon is a word that is well known by people. And it's just the mother of all wars. And so we have always been taught that as we come closer to the end time, crime is going to increase. There's going to be financial instability, moral decay, all of these sorts of things. The world is going to be at war. It's going to be a terrible time just before the Great Tribulation begins. That may be. But before these things do occur in their fullness, there's going to be world peace. But it's a deceptive peace. It is a counterfeit peace. Because the one who rides on the white horse is a counterfeit Christ, and he brings about a counterfeit peace. But there is going to be, temporarily, peace on earth, and what you might say, goodwill toward men. Now, here's what we need to be careful of. This is a deceptive peace. And that's going to create a false sense of security. You know, there was a day, and not too many years ago, when world leaders got caught up believing that there was going to be peace on earth, goodwill toward men. I mean, you go back to 1991. What happened in 1991? You had the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was Pope John Paul II who spoke of a world awakening from a nightmare to a better hope. It was Mikhail Gorbachev optimistically said, we see a budding world order in which peaceful coexistence and mutually beneficial cooperation based on goodwill will be a universal norm. In a speech that President George W. Bush gave to the American people, he said this, we're beginning a new era. This new era can be full of promise, an age of freedom, a time of peace for all peoples. I think it would do us well, too, to remember all the optimism that took place right before World War II, when Adolf Hitler came on the scene and promised to be a man of peace. except that Winston Churchill did not believe Adolf Hitler was telling the truth. But most world leaders did. In fact, I saw a book, William Manchester wrote a biography of Sir Winston Churchill, and he confronts us with the awful reminders of Hitler. Here are the words in Manchester's book. Thomas Jones, who had been in and out of Whitehall for a quarter century, wrote in his diary, "All sorts of people who have met Hitler are convinced that he is a factor for peace. He doesn't seek war, but friendship. Meeting the press after he had been closeted with Hitler, Lloyd George said he regarded him as the greatest living German. I only wish we had a man of his supreme quality at the head of affairs in our country today." I would prefer having Adolf Hitler run the country than Winston Churchill. Nazis were applauded by the Anglican clergymen. Here's the Church of England. And a group of them expressed their feelings toward the Nazis. Boundless admiration for the moral and ethical side of the Nazi program, they said. It's clear, stand for religion and Christianity and its ethical principles. Yeah. But Churchill was never deceived. I don't know if you saw the movie The Darkest Hour, but you can see that Churchill was not a very popular man. But he got us through that war. So the deception here that Adolf Hitler was able to create was almost universal. But once Hitler became Hitler and started marching his troops across Europe, the Anglican pastors, the clergymen, began to change their mind. Maybe we don't want him after all. In fact, they referred to him as the Antichrist. Dr. Kepler, who during World War II provided us with an example of how Hitler could well be the Antichrist, and he developed this formula. So this is his formula, okay? A, and this is the English language, by the way, A equals 100, B equals 101, C 102, D 103, and so on. Now, take Hitler's name. H has a value of 107, I a value of 108, T a value of 119, L a value of 111, E a value of 104, and R a value of 117. Now you add that all up and it comes to 666. Now in Revelation chapter 13, when we get there several weeks from now, we know that the name and the number of the Antichrist is 666. Now, obviously Hitler was not the Antichrist, but certainly Hitler was an Antichrist. We hear a lot of talk about the Antichrist. I mean, it's prolific amongst prophecy buffs. But the word is only mentioned four times in the whole Bible. Now, there are many different terms for the Antichrist. But the name Antichrist appears only four times, and they all appear in 1 John. And it says this, many Antichrists will come. So there are others out there, like Adolf Hitler, who is an Antichrist. But there is the Antichrist, and he is yet to come. But when he comes on the scene, he comes offering peace to the world. He comes riding astride a white horse, and we've named that white horse counterfeit. Because he is a counterfeit Christ, and he offers to the world a counterfeit peace. Okay, there's the first seal. Let's look at the second seal, verses 3 and 4. We'll go through this seal, and then we'll take a break. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, "Come and see." Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there was given to him a great sword. So notice now the parting of peace. Again, I believe the rider on this horse is the Antichrist. Remember, he comes on the scene astride a white horse, offering peace to the whole world. Now he switches horses. It's a blood red horse, a fiery horse. And he comes with a sword in his hand to take peace from the world. So notice next the plan of God for judgment. I've heard many Bible teachers talk on this, and they say, really, the great tribulation doesn't begin until the second half of the tribulation. And that's why the church will go through the first half of the tribulation. You know, there is that mid-trib view, that the church will go through the first half of the tribulation, and then the church is raptured, because the real day of God's wrath is not until the second half of the tribulation, the last 3.5 years. And I will acknowledge that perhaps the last 3.5 years are much worse than the first 3.5 years, especially for the nation of Israel. But I believe that the whole tribulation is bad, and none of us want to be here for any of it. It begins with peace, but it isn't long until he who rides on the white horse comes on a fiery red horse, carrying a sword. Carried a bow the first time with no arrows. Look, I'm harmless. But the second time he comes, he carries a sharp sword. Now, the thing that's interesting about this is God is the one who orchestrates exactly what the Antichrist does. That may seem strange. For example, if you notice verse 4, it says, it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth. It was granted to him who sits on this fiery red horse, carrying a sword in his hand. It was granted to him to make war. Who granted the Antichrist to make war? I have to believe God did. I have to believe that God is sovereign, that Satan cannot do anything that God doesn't want him to do. The Antichrist is helpless to do anything apart from God. And so God is allowing this war to take place. That's the only conclusion I can come to. So he gives permission to start the war. And I believe this war could well be in the first half of the tribulation, because we don't get to the middle of the tribulation until we get to chapter 11. Now, how much of this falls over into the second half, I don't know. I think perhaps some of it does, because we may be looking at an overall view of the Antichrist and these four horses. I decided to do a little research, because I thought, what do ancient Jewish rabbis believe in regards to the end times? I'm talking about men who lived maybe hundreds of years before the birth of Christ. What does some of the apocalyptic literature have to say? You know, that's the literature written between the Old Testament and the New Testament. What does some of that literature have to say in regards to the end times? Notice what the prophet Zechariah says. This is chapter 14, verse 13. And it shall come to pass in that day that a great panic from the Lord will be among them. Everyone will seize the hand of his neighbor and raise his hand against his neighbor's hand. Did you hear what Zechariah is saying? People are not going to get along with each other. And one neighbor is going to fight another neighbor. The intertestamental writings, I'm going back now 160 B.C., thereabouts. These are authors who spoke about the horrors of the end time. The book of Enoch, by the way, The book of Enoch is a very, very interesting book, and it's becoming very much popularized today. Now, when we talk about the book of Enoch, it was not written by Enoch of the Bible. There were people who were used pseudonames because they wanted their writings to be in the scriptures. And so you have a person, I don't know who it is, I don't think anybody knows who it is, who wrote the book of Enoch. Getting a lot of publicity today, this book. Here's what it says. From dawn to sunset, men will slay each other. Then you have the fourth book of Ezra. Now you know that Ezra is a scribe in the Old Testament. But this again is not the Ezra of the Old Testament. This is just somebody calling himself Ezra because, again, he wants his writings to be canonized. He says, friend shall war against friend. Friends will attack one another suddenly in the end times. The second book of Baruch says, envy shall rise in those who had no thought of themselves, and passion shall arise in him who is peaceful. Many shall be stirred up in anger to injure many, and they shall rouse up all men in order to shed blood, and in the end they shall all perish together. Doesn't sound like I want to be living in the end times. In fact, Jesus put it like this. Many will betray one another and will hate one another. It's interesting what these men living 160 years or so before the birth of Christ write in the Apocrypha about the end times. Kind of fits even what Jesus has to say. What Zechariah had to say. Now notice the pretense of peace and safety. This kind of fits in. Remember, Paul tells us one thing that's going to characterize the end times is people will be saying peace and safety. And remember too what Ezekiel has to say right before the nation of Israel is invaded by Russia and her Muslim allies in the battle of Gog and Magog. My people Israel dwell safely. So there's a sense of security here. What did we say about the rider on the white horse? He brings peace and safety to the world. He brings a covenant of peace between Jew and Muslim Arab. But it's a counterfeit peace. And so there's going to be a time when there's going to be peace on earth, goodwill toward men. But it's a deceptive peace. And people will be saying peace and safety, and all of a sudden, boop, war breaks out. And all the calamities that we're going to be studying as we go through breaking these seals that are in the hand of the Lamb, Jesus. So God doesn't want any of us to be deceived. And while world leaders seek to bring peace on earth, it's going to be a futile effort. However, during the tribulation, after the rapture of the church, on the scene comes this rider on a white horse and he has a bow in his hand. Peace. A covenant of peace. But then he switches horses. And now he's riding a fiery red horse of war. And he has a sword in his hand.
Why do you think it's the same rider on both horses?
I think that this portrays the whole ministry of the Antichrist.
So you think the rider is the Antichrist?
Pardon?
You think the rider on the horse is the Antichrist?
I do. That's a pretty common premillennial interpretation. I mean, I didn't make it up, but I did find that the people who hold the viewpoint that I hold pretty much, I may teach it differently, but I think that that's pretty well known. Okay, it's almost 10 minutes till 7. We'll take a break. 7 or 8 minutes or 10 minutes. We're going to talk about the black horse. I probably should have. I'm glad I'm covering this next section after you eat, but I guess, because you'll probably enjoy your food more now than you will if I were to talk about what I'm going to talk about when we come back after a snack. Okay, we'll take a break. Let me just make this announcement, if I could. Next week will be the last week to get your questions in. So if you have questions or you have what my opinion on whatever is on your mind, as long as it has a biblical slant to it, don't tell me how to solve the world's problems. If you have a biblical question or just whatever, please get the question in today or next week, and that will be the last opportunity. Okay.
I have a question about Ezekiel 38:39. Before. You said it could happen before the rapture, could happen after the rapture.
Uh-huh.
In your opinion, what's the latest that can happen?
I do not see this war as, though it's an increasingly popular position, that there, if you'll notice the end of the book of Revelation, it talks about the battle of Gog and Magog. In other words, when the millennial reign ends and the Satan is released from the bottomless pit, the nations flock to him in what is called Gog and Magog. And so a lot of people now are drawing support that that's when it's going to occur, at the end of the millennial reign. I do not hold that viewpoint. I believe it could occur any time, but I think it will occur before the rapture. I think it will occur before the tribulation. Maybe between the rapture. I believe there's a gap. I can understand there's a gap. I believe in the imminent return of Christ, which means Christ can come back at any time. But there are still prophecies that are unfulfilled. The Gog and Magog, for example, is an unfulfilled prophecy. The destruction of the city of Damascus is still an unfulfilled prophecy. We could name several. I don't believe that we have to wait for those prophecies to be fulfilled for Christ to return, because I believe in the imminent return. He could come at any time. And then these are things that can take place in the gap, because the tribulation begins when the Antichrist signs a covenant or gets a covenant sealed between the Muslim Arabs and the Jews over building a temple on Temple Mount. That is the beginning of the tribulation. So, bring your questions to me, and we've got 5 or 6 good ones, so we'll have fun with them. Okay, we're back to opening up the seals, and we're going to look now at the third seal. The first seal was a white horse called Counterfeit. The second seal was a fiery red horse called Conflict. And now we have a black horse named Commerce in verses 5 and 6. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." So I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat upon it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. And do not harm the oil and the wine." So notice there's a coming of a worldwide famine. Because once again, I believe the rider on this horse is the Antichrist. And notice he comes with a pair of scales in his hands. And the scales symbolize famine. The scales symbolize the economic problems that are going to occur during the tribulation. In other words, he's going to be one who's going to weigh out the food that people are going to be able to buy. So he's going to control the food. Notice he's riding on a black horse. And I thought it interesting that the black horse could well symbolize famine. And there's a passage in Scripture that I found that seems to illustrate that point. For example, Lamentations chapter 4, verses 4 through 8. We don't get into the book of Lamentations very often, do we? But it has to deal with the lamenting of Jeremiah after the city of Jerusalem was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar back in 586 B.C. Now, not everybody was taken into captivity. The poor, the lame, the elderly, the handicapped, they were all left behind. Jeremiah had a chance to go into the Babylonian captivity and be treated very nicely by Nebuchadnezzar, because Nebuchadnezzar had a lot of respect for Jeremiah, because Jeremiah was warning the people that he was coming. And Nebuchadnezzar got word of that. And so he offered Jeremiah, hey, I'll treat you very nicely, come along. But Jeremiah wanted to stay back in the land with those who were left behind. And he writes this. He talks about how Jerusalem, the people are starving, he says, from a great famine. He writes how the tongue of the infant clings to the roof of their mouths, and young children ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. Then he speaks about her Nazarites, who were once brighter than snow. Now they are blacker than soot, and their skin clings to their bones. They go unrecognized in the streets, he says. Lamentations chapter 4, I kind of summarized four verses there. So notice, people, when they are starving to death and their skin clings to their bones, their skin turns color, a blackish color. So once their skin was brighter than snow, now he says it's blacker than soot. So black symbolizes famine. Now notice the control of the Antichrist over the world's economy. We're going to get to Revelation chapter 13 sometime in this class. But I think you know what happens there. He's now in control. And so we have now what is talked about as the mark of the beast. And the mark of the beast is set up very much like Caesar worship was set up in the days of Rome, something that John was very familiar with. And we've talked a lot about that, haven't we? Where the Caesar set up headquarters all over various cities. And you would go there once a year, burn a pinch of incense to Caesar and say, Caesar is Lord. And you would get a certificate that would enable you to buy or sell. And if you didn't have that certificate, you couldn't buy or sell. And you can see that would be a very difficult thing for Christians. And that's why many of them died. And certainly a lot of persecution, because they couldn't buy, they couldn't sell. They had to get together and do their own things, I suppose, to keep them alive. But eventually all this caught up with them. And so we're going to see what the Antichrist does is set up centers throughout the world. And you have to go to those centers. And you have to acknowledge that the Antichrist is God. And then you receive a mark on your forehead or on your right hand. And that mark, I believe, is the number 666. It's the name and the number of the Antichrist. So we can see how he's going to control the economy. He's going to do so by people who will acknowledge him as God. So I see three causes for famine. This is in your notes, but not in your notes. It's not in your notes in the way in which I'm going to say it. But I'm going to cover all three of these things. I probably should have put it in a little clearer form, but I'll make it clear now. There's three causes of famine. The first cause is those in power control the economy. So that's exactly what we see here with the Antichrist. He has what? The scales in his hand. And so he's going to control the economy. I was listening to Dennis Prager here. It's been maybe a month or so back. And one of his programs was on famine. Actually, he was talking about communism and how famine occurred. And he said, most famines occur not because of drought, but most famines occur because of those in power. They control the economy. They control how much people can eat. They raise the prices so that people can't afford food. and they starve people to death. And so people in power will do that. I can see the Antichrist doing the very same thing. Those in power control the economy. Here's the second reason. Drought. And God is the one who brings about drought. He doesn't send rain. So what happens is the crops don't grow. And a third cause of famine is war. Because famine always follows the ravages of war. For example, during and immediately following World War I, more than 27 million people died of starvation from worldwide famines. More than 20 million people died of malnutrition and associated diseases during World War II. That is more than were killed in the war, which was 19.5 million. In other words, more people died of starvation during World War II than died during the war itself. During famines, desperate people will eat anything they can get their hands on, including cats, dogs, rats, and even other human beings. I saw a book called Fearful Famines of the Past. The author of that book writes of a famine in Russia in the year 1600, in which 500,000 people died. He said cats, dogs, and rats were eaten, the strong overcame the weak, and in the shambles of the public market, human flesh was sold. Multitudes of dead were found with their mouths stuffed with straw. This is not very pleasant, but it comes from Reader's Digest, so that might be of comfort. I've saved articles all the way back to the 1960s. I mean, I can pull out material from files. I've got thousands and thousands and thousands of resource material that I can get my hands on very quickly. And so I pulled out of my file a Reader's Digest article, April of 1969. It was entitled The 900 Days, The Siege of Leningrad, which today would be St. Petersburg, Russia. And so it's during World War II when husbands ate their wives, wives ate their husbands, and parents ate their children. And then there's an article about this man by the name of Dmitri, who went with a well-dressed man into his house to bargain for food. As they arrived on the top floor of the man's house, someone inside asked, "Who is it?" "It is me," the well-dressed man replied, "with a live one." Dmitri froze at the words. Then the door opened and he saw a hairy red hand and a mug-like face, and from the room came a strange, warm, heavy smell. Suddenly a gust of wind in the hall caught the door, and in the swaying candlelight, Dmitri got a glimpse of several hunks of white meat swinging from hooks on the ceiling. From one hook he saw a dangling human hand with long fingers and blue veins. The men lunged toward Dmitri. But he leaped down the stairs shouting, "Cannibals!" Fortunately, some soldiers were passing by and they shot and killed the cannibals. They found five human carcasses hanging in the house. Isn't that a pitiful story of what goes on when there's a famine? The cause of famines also is a curse from God. So that's one of the three that I pointed out. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, God, through Moses, is warning the children of Israel, they better obey his voice, because if they don't, God is going to shut up the heavens and it's not going to rain. Notice what the text says. This is verse 15, 17, 18, 23, 24. "But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, cursed be. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading trough. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the fruit of your ground, the increase of your cattle and the young of your flock, and the heavens over your head shall be brass. The earth under your feet shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain on your head powder and dust. From heaven it shall come down upon you until you are destroyed." So we see three causes of famine. We see where those in power control the economy, and this Antichrist has the scales in his hand. We see the ravages of war, And we see where God simply shuts up the heavens and makes them like brass so it doesn't rain. Now notice the cost of food during the tribulation. During the tribulation, God, through the Antichrist, is going to curse the land. The price for food will be very expensive. A quart of wheat for a denarius. Now, a denarius would be a day's wages. So you work all day, you get a denarius, and all you can buy is a quart of wheat, which only feeds one person. So here you are, the husband of a family, and you've worked all day, you've got your denarius, you go and buy a quart of wheat. What are you going to do? Feed yourself, feed your wife, feed your kids, because it's only food for one. Then he says, three quarts of barley for a denarius. In other words, if you want more food, you have to buy the barley. But the barley was animal food, low in nutritional value. It was very cheap. But now you can see the situation here. What is a man going to do? He's got a denarius. That is one day's wages. So he has a choice to make. Do I buy a quart of wheat and feed myself? Or do I buy three quarts of barley and feed my family? They get no nutrition and it's animal food. So do I get something that's nutritious or do I get dog kibble? See? Then he says, do not harm the oil or the wine. Well, that was used for making bread. Wine was used in cooking. But you see, there's no need of raising the price of oil and wine because you don't get enough food to do anything with it. So there's a warning here. A global famine is coming. It is the Antichrist who has the pair of scales in his hand. And he is the one who's determining the price of food. So we've seen the rider on three horses. The white horse called counterfeit. The red horse called conflict. The black horse called commerce. And now we'll close off by talking about the pale horse called corpse. Verses 7 and 8. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, come and see. So I looked and behold a pale horse, and the name of him who sat upon it was Death, and Hades followed with him. And power was given to him over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death. And I'm going to say that word there could better be translated pestilence because it's the same word. And by the beasts of the earth. So notice first of all the color of the pale horse. You may say pale, but the word in the Greek here is the word whereby we get our English word chlorine. So it's kind of a pale green in color. That would be how it's described. In fact, this word is actually translated green three other places in the New Testament. But green is also the color of leprosy. So this horse is a very sickly looking horse. Now notice the condemnation of those who follow the Antichrist. See, the Antichrist is followed by Hades. In other words, the rider on this horse, whose name is Death, Hades follows Death. What's Hades? Well, we're living at a time when Hades is the abode of the unrighteous dead. Okay? So everybody who is not a believer, when they die, they go to Hades. That's true today. It's the abode, an intermediate abode of the unrighteous dead. They remain in that abode until after the millennial reign of Christ. Then you have the bodily resurrection of the unsaved. And they go before the great white throne judgment. They hear the most painful words ever uttered, depart from me, I know you not. And they are cast into the lake of fire. That's why the book of Revelation closes with Death and Hades being cast into the lake of fire. So, this pale horse of death leads to Hades. Hades leads to hell. Now notice the command given to the Antichrist. Authority is given him to kill one-fourth of the earth. And again, I have to believe that authority comes from God, because the Antichrist can't do anything apart from God. Satan can't do anything apart from God. One-fourth of the earth is going to be killed. And if we were to look at that today and say, okay, the rapture of the church has occurred, and there's, let's say, 2 billion people have left, a fourth of the earth would be about 1.5 billion left. Now, is all of this going to happen in the first half of the tribulation? Maybe so. Or maybe this is a picture of the work of the Antichrist throughout, but we're going to see as we move through the book that there are more people who are going to die than what you see here in this horse called death or corpse. Notice the causes of death. Jesus talked about this in Matthew 24, verse 7. Wars, famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. Those are the signs that know we're coming close to the tribulation. But there's one more cause of death here, if you'll notice in our text, and that is the beasts on the earth. So, what beast might there be that could kill so many people? It is a rodent that you are very familiar with. It is a rodent that lives right here in Southern California. It is a rodent that lives all over the world. The most deadly animal on the face of the earth today is a rat. Rats are responsible for the loss of billions of dollars of food in America alone. Death all over the world. Rats, infested with bubonic plague, killed one-third of the population of Europe in the 14th century. Rats carry as many as 35 diseases at once. And amazingly, if 95% of the rat population is exterminated, it will replace itself in less than a year. Rats have killed more people than all the wars of history, and they always make their home where men dwell.
Opportunistic feeders.
Pardon?
I was on a boat up to the Inland Passage, you know, up to the...
To Alaska?
Yeah. And the interpreter on board was talking about the eagles, mm-hmm. and how they, you know, scavenge in the big dump.
Yeah.
He said they're opportunistic feeders.
Oh, of what?
Of whatever's there.
Whatever's there. That's well, hope they get some rats. So you can see, with wars and famines and earthquakes, sanitation goes. With no medicine, living conditions descend to a primitive level. And rats may well be the beast that kills. So here's the conclusion from four of the seals. You see, when the Lamb Jesus gets that scroll and begins to break open the seals, there's a lot of rejoicing in heaven because they want to know those things that are going to take place. And then you have, first of all, the white horse of conquest. There's the promise of peace. And then you have the red horse of conflict. Comes war. And then you have the black horse of commerce. Then comes famine. And finally, you have the pale horse of corpse. Called corpse, and that brings about death. But here is the reason why you can leave here tonight happy, happy, happy. Yes. Because I want you to leave here happy, happy, happy. Because this has not been a happy lesson. And it's not my intention that every lesson make you feel good. Because if you're going to teach the word honestly, I mean, we just might as well get downright truthful. And the book of Revelation has some very unpleasant things to talk about. But why you can leave here happy every night is because we're out of here and we don't have to live in this kind of a mess. Amen. Okay. That's it.